Ask questions with genuine curiosity, focus on impact, not your intent, and then thank them because they didn't have to tell you. And a lot of times when people have a marginalized identity, they often don't tell someone from the privileged group that they did harm because their experiences often get invalidated with intent.
Welcome to the Ladies Who Lead podcast. This is a community of women supporting women. Tune in every other Thursday to hear from SK Vaughn as she catches up with ordinary ladies doing extraordinary things. We will cover topics like diversity and inclusion, gender pay gap, thought leadership, and respect in the workplace. We want to celebrate with you and hear stories of success and hard lessons learned. Whether you are a lady who leads in the boardroom or a lady who leads in your community, this is the place for you. Let's do this.
Capri C. Hollins was born and raised in Seattle, Washington. She received a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology from Seattle University and a Master of Arts and Doctor of Psychology in Clinical Psychology with an emphasis in Multicultural and Community Psychology from California School of Professional Psychology. Dr. Hollins has over 25 years of experience working with ethnically diverse populations, facilitating workshops on racism, and teaching graduate courses, including 20 years with the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology as an associate professor of counseling. After serving as the first director of equity and race relations for Seattle Public Schools, she co-founded Cultures Connecting LLC in 2008. Her organization provides culturally relevant professional development, keynotes, leadership coaching, and consulting services to organizations seeking to improve their ability to effectively engage in race conversations and dismantle institutional racism. Dr. Hollins wrote Inside Out, The Equity Leader's Guide to Undoing Institutional Racism, and co-authored Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, Strategies for Facilitating Conversations on Race. She is a Seattle 2020 TEDx speaker on what white people can do to move race conversations forward. Dr. Hollins works hard to balance her passion and commitment to equity and social justice, while at the same time centering the importance of family and community. This is an incredible episode with Dr. Hollins, where we really dive deep into race relations, color blindness, and everything else in between. This is a conversation that's frankly not the easiest and is great at making you think deeper and asking more questions. So buckle up, because this is an incredible conversation. All right. I am so excited today. It is a privilege and honor to be here with Dr. Hollins, and this is an incredible episode y'all are going to love. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, SK.
Yes. We'll always kick off the episode with how are you surviving and thriving this week? And so I will go first in my surviving mode, which is a little bit silly in the grand scheme of things, but I'm not a morning person, okay? So bear with me. I decide it's a great day to get in the car, add my dog into the car, and we decide to go to Starbucks and grab a quick drink before we kick off the work day. And I'm talking to my sister about all the things that are going down in Alabama right now, just with IVF and all this craziness around us. And I've got my dog, I've got the really kind barista who's trying to hand me all of the things, right? Of course, I don't just get one drink, I get a chocolate croissant or bagel. And so I have all the things. My dog's getting the pup cup, so she sees that in the corner of her eye and is trying to go for it. Well, I'm trying to have this very like interesting conversation with my sister all before, you know, about 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'm just like, what is wrong with me? Do I just invite this chaos into my life? So I was surviving a little bit this past week with that funny, just like morning cup of coffee, which was a very interesting start to my day. I did not spill it all in my car this time around, so that's a win for me. But I am thriving in just this season of great guests coming on the podcast. I'm so encouraged that you're here with us today, but I just feel like there's just been a new chapter we're entering into. And it's just such a sweet chapter of hearing just thought-provoking stories and ideas and hard lessons learned and things that you have to unlearn. And it's just a beautiful journey of educating ourselves. And I'm just very thankful to be entering into the space of, okay, what do I truly believe as an individual, apart from maybe what I was taught, maybe apart from all the things around me that's influenced me over time, and just trying to really think of it as myself and what's my truth? Where do I fit in the fabric of it all? And it's an interesting time, but it's been a really thought-provoking season, and I'm just thriving in that. What about you?
Yeah, wow. Gosh, my week last week was so busy, and I had one of those weeks where I didn't know if I was coming or going. You know, I'm trying to complete a second edition of a book my business partner and I wrote, and we're behind on it, and she's moving faster than I am, and then I start to feel guilt, and I've got to catch up, and then the emails and the family life and just so many different things. And so I've got to have routine, SK, and it's got to include coffee. So I get up and I've got to have my cup of coffee. Don't talk to me until I've had that, you know. And I do some journal writing. I might, you know, look at the word for the day, maybe my horoscope, anything that could kind of, you know, lift me up. And then I really begin my week. I go to church, which is something I didn't grow up with. And it just helps to center me. And I love, SK, to read books with Ikke women with swords, you know, and little magic, you know, so I can just kind of escape. And so I have to do that every night, and coffee every morning, and a lot of things in between to just help me stop and breathe and get centered. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Hollins, tell us a little bit more about yourself and just kind of what has led you to your current role.
You know, so it's a great question, and one that I often share with people. So I grew up here in Seattle, Washington, white mom, Catholic, married early on, had my four older brothers and sisters, blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, all white children. And then later in life, she had me and my younger sister. And, you know, I was born at a time in our country when interracial relationships, marriages, were still illegal. And so, you know, not only do I have the racial diversity, but I have a brother that's gay. My Black grandparents, who didn't have children of their own, legally adopted my white mom when she was 41. You know, my dad married a woman from Thailand, all this diversity. And I go to graduate school never having talked about race formally. And my doctorate is in psychology, and I minored in what's essentially now diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And it was the first time that I'm looking at myself as a racialized being and through the lens of institutional and systemic racism, and I am blown away. I recognize for the first time that I have privilege as a light-skinned Black woman. I'm recognizing that I have stereotypes, that I have bias, all of these things that, you know, I thought was something bad. And so I'm gaining language. I'm learning language to describe my experiences. And I start to, you know, I go through an emotional roller coaster, but I start to feel some liberation. And I want other people to feel it too. And so I did private practice for a while, and I'm like, yeah, this isn't really for me. And I started teaching graduate school in the subject of race relations, and it went from there. But I think that, you know, that was really my beginning, my own story and experience, and realizing other people have stories, other people are being racialized, and they are internalizing superiority and inferiority, and they don't know what to do with it. You know, in a nutshell, that's the beginning for me.
Love that. And what is some of the work that you're doing today that you just look back on and you're like, yes, this all makes sense that we've gotten to this place and to this point, and this feels so right. What can you talk a little bit more about, like, present day with your existing role?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was really shy. I was an introvert. I'm still an introvert, though most people who experience me in workshops would never guess that. I, you know, had what is sometimes referred to as the disease to please. I was afraid of upsetting people, and I shrank. I had a hard time letting my voice be heard. And, you know, as I re- reflect on this kind of full circle is, you know, just the power in my voice and being able to speak my truth unapologetically, you know, recognizing what white people and people of color are doing with me all the time and not letting that be what shapes how I show up in relationships in the spaces, to be able to say, SK, that I am beautiful, I am a queen, I am smart and talented, and have so much to offer the world, all things that I could never have done before because I was too, my mind spent more time on making sure that other people were comfortable being around me than I was manifesting what I feel is God's purpose for me in my life. And I recognize that everybody has different gods and not everybody believes in God. But for me, that's my experience, you know, and my truth. And it is very liberating to live your life that way.
I love that. Thank you for sharing. What do you say to people who say racism is a thing of the past?
You know, I saw that question and thought, how am I going to answer that? And I always tell people that facilitating conversations on race is so much easier than a one-on-one conversation, because people who think that way have typically are white people, typically are, you know, people that have privilege, that not necessarily bad people, it's just they've been socialized and they've had a lifetime of developing that way of thinking. And we live in a country where our country is very intentional about keeping white people thinking that way. So, you know, to answer that one-on-one is much more challenging for me than, let me take you through some activities and then tell me what you think. Or let me call in some other people to share their experiences and stories, and then let me check in and see what your thinking is now. But just, you know, the question in general, people who think that racism is a thing of the past, I think the reason that they do that is because if I think that way, and I'm a good, kind, loving, moral, ethical person, and I begin to entertain a different reality, then that means I'm going to have to do something different in order to stay aligned with that sense of identity around a good, loving, moral person. And so really, what do people have to give up in order to believe that racism is very much alive today? And it's not just overt racism, Ku Klux Klan, you know, white supremacists, but it's also the subtle way in which racism plays out in our banking system, the way it plays out in the curriculum that our students are exposed to or not exposed to, who gets into college and who doesn't, where people live, healthcare, you know, banking, all of these institutions, which we're frankly, particularly white people, are not trained to see, right? They don't have the experiences, the barriers, not based on their race, certainly based on class, certainly based on ableism, their maybe a disability, their sexual orientation. They can see it there because it connects to their experiences. But racism is harder for them to see because it's not something that they personally experience.
Sure. And what would you say is colorblind thinking? You talked about this in a recent TED talk, I believe, that you gave, which was really great, by the way. But you spoke a little bit about this, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about kind of the approach in which colorblind thinking prevails kind of in all groups.
Yeah. Again, you know, part of the message in that TEDx talk is that I don't mean all, right? And so, but I do look through a racial equity lens around what are the themes, what do we see happening, how might people's experiences be different because of their race, because of their gender, what have you. And, you know, white people, I think, who want to be different than, let's say, the generation before or how their grandparents might have been, will, you know, the approach before was to see race and to see it as negative, right? Desegregation, othering, less than. And then you kind of like the pendulum swings in the other direction. And then that person who sees themselves as a good, kind, loving, moral, ethical white person then takes the approach, well, I won't see race at all. That's how I'll be better than that generation. By the way, that generation is still around. Presently, we see it happening all over our country, right? Particularly after the election of the 45th president. But colorblind thinking is to say, I don't notice your race. And what white people will often do, SK, is they'll say, I don't see race. We have a friend who is Black, right? And then you're like, well, how do you know that friend is Black if, you know, you're colorblind? But they're not really saying, the message is conveying they don't see race. But if you ask them what they mean by that, they'll say, I don't judge them because of their race. I'm not going to treat them badly because of their race. And then my question becomes, well, why can't you see their race and treat them fairly and treat them, you know, in a positive way? Why does that have to go away in order for you to see them as human beings, essentially? And so colorblind thinking, I think, is the intent is to be good, to do good, to treat people fairly. But the impact is then you don't see all of who I am. Then you're not going to be curious about how my experiences might be different from yours because of my race. You can't get to equity, you know, righting the wrongs from the past, because then we're all the same. And we're not all the same. There are cultural differences and racial experiences that drive how we see the world, how we are treated in the world. And so while, again, it comes from a good place, it's very harmful.
That makes sense. I definitely understand where you're coming from on that. That does make complete sense to me. Are you looking for a new membership to really plug into, find community, and really begin thriving? Well, we have just the membership for you at the Ladies Who Lead podcast. We have a membership on Patreon that is the Thriving Membership. It's only $5 a month. You get exclusive content, bonus episodes, sneak peek of the new merch, and early access to all of our announcements and promotions that are happening right here, right now. You're just the first person to know about it. If this sounds like the membership group for you, don't hesitate to sign up as we link it in our show notes. It's patreon.com/theladieswholead. And this is an incredible membership you do not want to miss out on. How can parents talk to their kids about race? Because I feel like it starts with the next generation, right? It only can get better, right? But how can parents realistically talk? You mentioned about your own family, and that wasn't a big part of the conversation. What can parents do differently with this next generation?
My mom did not talk with me about race. And she saw me doing an interview on a local radio station. And afterwards, she talked to me and she was pretty emotional. And she was apologetic. And I said, you know, Mom, because my mother knew that racism existed. She was actually active during the civil rights for Black people who were being wrongly imprisoned, bringing them, you know, reading materials. But she thought if she loved me well enough, that was, you know, that would buffer the experiences of racism. I would say that most people of color, particularly Black parents, talk to their children about race. So even with that question, not that parents of color don't have something to learn, I would say, how do white parents talk with their children about racism? And one of the things is to be curious with them, right? When they're watching a cartoon, you know, point out and ask them a question around, you know, I wonder why, you know, this might be happening, or what are your thoughts about? So I used to, I always say, my children are going to be in therapy, you know, I just don't know at what age, because their mother is a psychologist who talks about racism all day long. And so we would you know, go pick a greeting card out for their dad when they were younger. And I'd say, notice about these greeting cards, right? And I want my children to notice there are no greeting cards for Latino families. There are no greeting cards for Black parents, right? You're going to have to pick a generic card without an image on it. But I help my children just by asking them questions. So I'll give you an example. My son went to an all-boys school, predominantly white, in high school. He's a sophomore. We're driving in the car. This is where I hold my kids hostage because I'm so busy and I don't get on the phone. You never know at what point they're going to have a conversation with you. So I need to be available, right? So my son says, Mom, do you think it's okay if white people say the N-word? Now, SK, I am triggered by this. My automatic response or go-to is in my mind is, no, they cannot. And you better not be saying it either. Right? And I'm thinking, okay, what do you teach in your workshops, talking with children about race? I go to a question, right? Why do you ask? What are your thoughts, right? So when you ask questions, what it helps you to do is get a better sense of where your child's thinking is at. And so rather than spending 15 minutes lecturing on your thoughts about it, you can find out what their thoughts are and then fill in the blanks, right? But I would say if I was to give parents one strategy, instead of going immediately to educating them, first get curious with them, find out what their thinking is.
That's great advice. I love always turning instead of an answer just into a question, because I think people naturally start to really help fill in the gaps for you and then help you to kind of reach that same conclusion together without shoving it necessarily down someone. You know, I even think about that, like in the room when you're talking about, you know, we could try this approach, or what do you think about this approach? Or just trying to, like, you know, bring people along in the conversation that doesn't feel like a no, but it feels like an invitation into the conversation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then for children, whether they're younger or you've got adolescent children, you know, you're going to lose them very quickly because we do tend to go to education mode. And the education mode tends to align with our values. And often in that educating, there is a shaming of our children. And then what my children end up learning is don't ask questions, right? Because mommy's going to lecture you on why that thing is or isn't okay, rather than guiding them. So when I always say when I'm doing it right, you know, I don't always go immediately to questions. Sometimes I got to circle back around and say, hey, you know, you asked me something. I immediately started lecturing you and I never even asked you, what are your thoughts? And you can do that with what's happening in the media, you know, what's happening in the news. You know, we talk about talking with children about race are the books that you read to your children. You don't have to directly be talking with them about some topic on race. The museums you have them visit, the communities that you expose them to are all a part of that. Developing a healthy racial and ethnic identity for them.
Yeah, definitely. Has there been a profound experience in your workshops that made you take a step back and just really appreciate the work that you're doing? Can you think of an experience?
Oh my gosh, yes, yes. So Cultures Connecting started about 15 years ago, maybe 16. And before that, I first started facilitating conversations on race with graduate students. I'd do a 4-day intensive. So they'd go Friday and Saturday, and then a month later, they'd come back with homework in between. And there'd be 70 to almost 100 students in the class, depending on the year, predominantly white with a handful of students of color. And one day I was teaching and the class got really intense. There was a white woman who struggled with a conversation that I was having with her. And the next day, she didn't come back to class. Now, I don't know it, SK. I got, you know, 80 students in this class. And another white student said, you know, Dr. Hollins, aren't you going to talk about the fact that, you know, let's say her name was Michelle, that Michelle, you know, didn't come back to class? And some other student was like, yeah, we need to talk about that. And in that question, it didn't feel like genuine curiosity. It was more like, you hurt this student and now she's gone. What are you going to do about it? And then a student of color of Indian descent stood up, who'd never spoken the other 2 days in class. She stood up and she said, I've been gone for years and nobody ever asked like why I was missing. And, you know, those weren't her exact words, but she was essentially saying, I have spent my life assimilating into white culture and no one ever asked me, where are you? Or I value you for who you are. And please bring your full self into the spaces. That like took my like commitment to elevating the voices and experiences of people of color in a way that for many years, I think I had intellectualized it to some degree. It just really hit home for me. And then what she did was, she started coming back to some of the other classes and she'd bring me these gifts and pictures and stories. And one of her stories was at graduation, when they were playing music, she had to go 3 times up to the DJ to say, no, I want you to play my Indian music. And that was something that she would have never done before, wouldn't even had asked or wanted Indian music being played. And so what was profound for me was that I helped this person begin that journey of finding herself again, because there are far too many of us really that spend our lives making white people feel comfortable being around us. And that's how we dress, how we speak, what our hair looks like, you know, skin bleaching creams, straight hair straightening, you know, all of these things that say, well, now will you respect me? Now will you see me? Will you value me? And so that really had an impact on my, you know, on my teaching.
Yeah, I could see how that would. What would be some actionable strategies our listeners can take for skill building to engage effectively across different cultures?
Yeah, I wrote a whole book about this, right, SK. So, you know, I was thinking like, gosh, when I get asked that question, I like, it depends, right? And part of the challenge is that this work is adaptive. It's not technical. So I always tell people, you know, how you drove to work required something technical of you. There are all these rules that you must follow in order to get from one place to another. But in conversations about race, it all depends, right? Like, people are far more complex than just like, here are 10 things to do. So, you know, I always tell people these are tools for your backpack. Sometimes they'll work, sometimes they won't. But I will, you know, one thing I would like for listeners to think about is when they are the one who offends, commits a microaggression, says something that is harmful, that they didn't intend to do harm, but nonetheless had an impact. I think for me, what I used to do was I avoided conflict. And so to lean in is something that I think if you are a conflict avoider, you know, can be hard to do. But one thing is just to listen and believe that when that person is telling you, whether it's verbally or non-verbally, that you've said or done something offensive, listen and believe that that is their experience. And then lean in and just like I had shared with talking with children about race, ask questions with genuine curiosity, find out more. You didn't know that it was offensive to use that language to say that thing. So here's an opportunity for you to wonder so that you can learn from that person why that thing was harmful. You know, this is where that switching from assuming positive intent that puts the responsibility on the person who's been harmed to, you know, to really to do all the heavy lifting, that you focus more on your impact. help me understand. Are you saying that? Would you be open or willing to share with me what language is used if that isn't the language, right? We always call these, you know, hurt so good moments. It hurts to know that I've harmed you, but it's good that you took the risk to tell me. Because if you didn't tell me, then I wouldn't know, and I continue to do that thing. And so, and then thanking them. So listen and believe, ask questions with genuine curiosity, focus on impact, not your intent, and then thank them because they didn't have to tell you. And a lot of times when people have a marginalized identity, they often don't tell someone from the privileged group that they did harm because their experiences often get invalidated with intent. You know, that's not what I meant, or it was just a joke, or, you know, stop being so sensitive. And so thanking them and saying, I really appreciate that you were willing to tell me, and then apologize. A lot of times what people do is they'll apologize first. And I always think, you know, no, we need to talk about this first. And I want you to give an authentic apology. And if you don't know why it was hurtful and you're apologizing immediately, then, you know, you really don't know what you're apologizing for. And then go learn more, right? And then advocate and educate and teach other people what you learned so that you can, you know, affect the people around you. So those, you know, those are some strategies for when you're the one that does something harmful, which we all do. I still do. I always joke and tell people if I spend enough time with you, I promise you I can offend you too, but not because I like offending, but because I'm constantly pushing myself to grow and trying new language. And so when I'm doing that, it means I'm learning. And when I'm learning, it means I'm practicing. And that means I'm going to make mistakes.
Absolutely. What advice would you give to your younger self? Looking back on it now, what advice would you give?
I would tell the little me, the younger me, to not let other people's brokenness shape my identity, to not let the trauma and harm and hurt that other people put on you unknowingly often shape, you know, how I see myself, that I am a unique person made the way that I am for some reason and purpose, and to not let other people make me feel like I am less than who I am, and to walk in the world with my shoulders, you know, back and my head held high. And yeah, that's what I would tell me. Because then, SK, I didn't have to waste all those years in therapy undoing the damage that I, you know, let in to my life, right?
Sure. I think we've all spent years in therapy for different brokenness in our life. So I think that's a very beautiful and transparent way of putting it. So I'm with you. How do you define success? This is one of my favorite questions because I've always asked this one question to every person who comes on. And I think it's different for each person. But how would you define success for yourself?
Well, I define it as balance, thinking about my physical, my psychological, my spiritual, and social life, and being able to have balance in those things so that I feel this sense of peace, being able to walk in the world in a way that says I am living my best life. I'm living a life that makes me feel good, that feeling then has an influence and impact on other people. And I think, you know, being financially stable, being connected to something that's greater than myself, being connected to family, and then that psychological, you know, I always, sometimes SK, I have to remind myself, I love me some Caprice, right? And then when things are off kilter in one of those areas too much, then I, you know, it just, my life just doesn't feel right. And so I think about the balance in different aspects of my life makes me feel like I am successful.
Yes. Great answer. Well, this has been a joy to get to hear from you and to learn and to grow and be stretched in a lot of different ways. So thank you for taking the time today to share your truth and your shared experiences. Before we head out, what is your shameless plug? How can our listeners find you online?
So go to our website, culturesconnecting.com, sign up for our mailing list. We do workshops open to the public, talking with children about race, hiring and retaining a diverse workforce, all different types of workshops. And you'll get our newsletter, pick up my book, Inside Out, not a great title, Disney movie, but the Equity Leader's Guide to Undoing Institutional Racism. And then you can get some more strategies. So yes, thank you. Thanks, SK, for having me. It's been a pleasure. And I appreciate this podcast and what it's meant to do is really lifting the voice of women in a male-dominated society where we as women often have to learn how to find our voice. And I think your podcast is one avenue for us doing that.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the kind words and come back anytime.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Ladies Who Lead podcast. Looking for another way to engage with the Ladies Who Lead podcast? Check out our Instagrams and our show notes at The Ladies Who Lead. And don't forget to check out our website, www.theladieswholead.com. Until next time, I'm SK Vaughn.